This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is How to Be Prepared for Loved Ones Dying. One of the critical skills to living a long, healthy, happy life is dealing well with loved ones dying. If you live long enough, it happens. And if you're devastated or overwhelmed by a death, you become vulnerable to depression and illness. Judy Strong has given a lot of thought and study to how to be prepared for the loss of a loved one, both emotionally and logistically. She is the author of the very helpful book, No Time to Grieve, A Survivor's Guide to Loss and Healing. Judy, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be there.
When your husband died, you were pretty unprepared. How unprepared were you?
Well, actually, at the time, my husband had had rheumatoid arthritis most of his life, and so we had dealt with that. He'd had some corrective surgeries, but we never ever thought that he would get so bad that it would really cost him his life. He went in to have knee surgery, and while he was there, right before the operation, they had kind of a heart situation that came up. The doctor called me. I was still at home. And they said they were going to do an angiogram, and they ended up doing angioplasty, and he never did have the knee surgery. He just went downhill. It seemed to be just one crisis after the next. He had strokes. He became brain damaged. And then finally, 5.5 weeks after he went into the hospital, he died. So my children and I were completely unprepared.
What did you do first?
Well, first of all, I sat down with the kids, and I knew that my first priority was dealing with the emotions, healing, binding up wounds, and getting all of us a little bit stabilized. I knew that that was the most important thing to do, and I had taken the kids to the hospital with me, so we had gone through all of this together, but it's really always a shock. So we sat down, we kind of talked about what needed to be done. I had a part-time job, but I knew I needed eventually to have a full-time job, and I began to think about doing that. And I think for the rest of that year, he died January 8th, 1991, and for most of that first year, we tried to just stabilize ourselves, and it wasn't really until the second year that I dug into other kinds of things, like going back to school and getting a better job.
Now, how old were the kids at the time?
My oldest daughter was 25. She was working and living in Wyoming. She had graduated college. My second daughter was 20. She was a student at the junior college and living at home. And my two boys were 15 and 17. They were a freshman and a junior in high school.
Knowing everything that you know now, how would you talk about death with a 15-year-old?
Well, I would talk to them about the importance of bonding in a relationship. My two boys were close to their dad. He was the kind of dad who took them hunting and fishing, sat and talked to them. He was a Civil War historian, and he would share his life with them. I think it's very important that kids, as they're growing up, spend quality time with their both parents, but especially for the boys, it was important that they have this bonding with their dad.
I'm not understanding how the bonding fits with what you tell them. Talk about you were very close to your father, but what now?
Well, I talked to them about the way that he had handled family things. He loved his job. He did a job he loved, and he was a salesman. I told them that as they were growing, because they were really at that point in life where they needed to think about what they wanted to do, I told them to think about the example that he set and to plan their lives accordingly. We knew that we would have a struggle. They wanted to go to college, and in fact, they have done very well. One of my sons just got his PhD last March in psychology. My other son is an engineer, but it was a struggle. It took a little longer, but I emphasized the perseverance that my husband had had, that dogged determination to overcome adversity.
So rather than seeing the glass half empty, you were emphasizing that they were lucky to have such a great role model who taught them values, who taught them coping skills, and now it's time to carry on his legacy, use those skills, and even teach them to others.
Yes, that's right. And both of them have really done that. We all talk about things. One of my boys got married last year, and this was a poignant time. And when my other son got his PhD, this is the time when, even though it's been a lot of years, that one person is still missing, and you kind of wish that that person could be there. And so there's a little nostalgia.
So one of the things you've learned is to anticipate anniversary effects on not just the anniversary of your husband or their father's death, but also other key points in a person's life, like marriage and graduation and first baby.
Yes, things like that come up in everybody's life. And when that one important person is gone, you always remember them. And this is part of the legacy that you have. And I think that it's an important aspect of healing and moving forward that you take the time to think about those things. I talk in some of my newsletters about rebuilding your life by accident or design, and I believe strongly that it's important to sit down and make those things keepsakes rather than try to push it away because it's painful. I think it's important to claim those things. This is what helps us to build coping skills. This is what helps us to be able to move forward. I think we have to embrace these emotions, and then as we move along, it's not quite so bad. They're what I call your keepsakes.
When you're meeting with the funeral director, they're talking about, oh, we can get this flag for you, we can do a memorial book, we can do a video. What have you found to be the most meaningful keepsakes for people, and what have you found are the things that just sit around and gather dust, and you wonder, why in the world did I do that?
Some of the things that are the most meaningful are those photos that you take, not the posed ones, but those candid photos you take at gatherings, family gatherings, out at the lake, out on vacation, the funny things that people do, and keep them in a book. My kids will sit down and look at them, and even though they're grown now, and they were just kids then, they'll sit and talk. It kind of helps the kids to bond to one another. And some of the other things are the funny things they'll ask me about. Funny stories of things that happened when they were very little and maybe they've forgotten about them, things their dad did or things we did together. It's really the memories more so than the material things, although my husband had some things that he really enjoyed. He was a Civil War historian, and the kids used to sit with him and he'd show them his artifacts, and this helps them to see him as a whole person.
Stories are something that if you don't tell them frequently, you forget the details, and you try to tell it a few years later, and it just, it's lacking what it had. I would think it'd be a great time, not necessarily the first week or something, but to get a tape recorder out and tape record some of the memories and stories that people have so that people can have that detail and richness and passion in hearing the story.
That's a great idea. I think some families are starting to do things like that because you do forget. You think that you're going to remember everything and you don't. That's one of the reasons I started to journal, because I wanted to eventually write a book. And I knew that if I didn't write those things down, I would forget them, and putting them on tape, some kind of a recording, make a CD or something and keep it in your computer, then you can always listen to it or look at pictures and things again. And this is what keeps families going as they grow up and they get married, they have children. This is the whole family legacy.
Now, I suspect that an awful lot of journals are pretty dull reading. People just said, oh, I felt bad today, and I cried a lot, and wouldn't really want to go back and read that. What distinguishes a really good journal that you'd want to go back and read?
Well, what I did was I would write down, I didn't write every day, but I would write several times a week, and I would just jot down things that had come up, problems that I had, and how I planned on solving them. Then I would write down how I felt. I would try to jot down the specific emotions, whether I was sad or angry or worried, or if I had a good day. And a couple weeks later, I made a habit of going back and reading what I had written, because you can follow along, and it gives you confidence. It gives you a sense of hope that actually you did have some problems and you solved them. You felt really awful, and now you feel better. And I think that helps you to feel that you are moving forward. Some days you really don't think you're getting anywhere. It helps the individual, even if you never read it again. There have been studies that have shown that when people do journal while they're grieving, the fact that you're sitting down and engaging the brain and actually writing down these things, it does help the healing process.
I haven't studied up in journaling. I'm not an expert on it, but top of my head, I'm thinking of four benefits. One, you were talking about that it's kind of therapy. Another, that you measure your progress and you see, gee, I'm not as overwhelmed as I was a few months ago. Another is that you capture some of the vivid memories. And again, that like the tape recording or like the photos, things that a year or two later might be hard to get in touch with. And that can also be great material for books or family gatherings.
Well, sometimes I think what people will do, they'll take a journal. Sometimes they'll have more than one person in the family keep a journal, and then they'll compare, and they may not actually publish it for the public.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take that journal and go somewhere, Kinko's even, and have it bound, have it run off, and just keep a few copies around for the family. And when you get together, sit down and say, okay, here's what we went through a couple of years ago. Do you remember that Christmas? Do you remember that birthday when everybody was so sad and we tried to enjoy the cake and the party? And this is what had happened. And I think that for a family to keep that, as you say, it's hard to remember years later, but it kind of binds you together and helps you remember that person really mattered, but you've managed to move forward and you can remember them in a lighter vein.
And in our high-tech society, we've got these interesting twists where you could do a blog or a website, and it's not that you want other people outside the family to find this, although, you know, what if they do, but that family members can each contribute something, or you could even have a tradition of once a month everybody makes an entry on the blog and keeps all of you kind of bound together with this experience and healing from the experience.
Yes, I think a lot of families today, because they don't live very close to one another anymore, are looking for ways and means to stay connected. Connectedness is so important. And if you put something up on the computer, just a family page, a little bit of genealogy, some memories that people have, funny stories, it's wonderful for families to share funny stories about one another. You can all go on the computer, you can even get a webcam, and you can talk to each other. And these are the things that I think help bridge the gap, because a few generations ago, everybody grew up in the same place and they hardly ever left. They had several generations mm-hmm. that even lived together. Today, you just don't have that. And people are finding it's very, very important to stay connected.
I'm going to take you back to when you were talking with your 15-year-old son. Besides bonding and role model and legacy, what else did you emphasize with him?
I talked to him about the fact that he had gotten this arthritis when he was probably in his late 20s. He had it when I married him. He coped with it all those years. I talked to both of the boys about what they wanted to do with their lives. And I also mentioned to them how their dad felt about them. They knew from their own experiences, but as their mother, I knew the kinds of things that the two of us had talked about, our goals and our dreams and our hopes for our children. And I told both of them how much he really appreciated the wonderful things he saw in them, the assets that he saw in them, and the dreams and the goals that he had set for for them, not that they had to particularly live out his dreams, but he saw their potential. And I wanted them to realize, I wanted them to carry this throughout life, that their dad really did make a difference. Because when you're a teenager and all your kids, all your all their friends have dads who are relatively healthy, this was particularly hard on my boys.
I would think for just about anybody, one of the questions going through their minds is, you know, how much did Dad love me, or whoever the person was? I know my father was very salt of the earth person, very responsible and conscientious and a good father, but he not the kind of person that would ever say, I love you. I always felt that I knew it. I didn't need to hear it. But my brother and sister said, gee, I wish he had told me that. And mm-hmm. so that's a place where the mother can come in and say he really did, even if he couldn't express it verbally.
Right. And I think this is what helps people develop those life skills, those coping skills, so that they learn fairly early in life from a very major tragedy that the whole family can cope. We can help one another. We can talk about things. And this is something I think they have carried out through their lives. This gives them, I think, an edge a little bit that other kids their age probably did not have, because when things are always going well, you don't, and you don't struggle quite that much, you're not really learning those coping skills. And I think this ultimately helps you to live a happier life, a better life, because stress has such an enormous effect on the mind and the body.
I know you're also working on a book for talking with children about the death of a parent that's probably due out in about 9 months. What would you have said to, say, a six-year-old in the situation that you had?
Well, what I found through my research, I did research for the book, and I also interviewed 8 people who had been at different ages when they lost a parent. What I have found, and what research indicates, is that what children need is to feel safe. The younger the child, of course, the more insecure they feel because there's so much they don't understand. I would tell the child particularly that there are people there who will take care of them. There are people they can count on, people who love them. They will be okay. They will have a place to live. Children that age are very concrete. They need to know they'll have a roof over their heads, a warm bed. And I would tell them that I was going to spend time with them, depending on whether I was a family friend or a teacher or whatever, that I would spend time with them, check in with them, and try to answer questions. They need security, and they need their questions answered, and this is really difficult because sometimes as adults we don't quite know what to say. Children want facts, and we can't always give them facts. But being there on a regular basis is what helps them start to heal and deal with the death.
I think one of the things that brings that home for me is my 8-year-old twins. Even though they're very confident and they have each other, at nighttime, you know, I'll go upstairs and they'll say, Dad, won't you stay downstairs until we go to sleep? So it's that wanting to be protected, taken care of, to feel safe, that probably extends at least until early teens as a dominant issue for people.
Yes, children do. They know that they're vulnerable. They know that compared to adults, they really don't have a lot of power. And those parents are their whole world. We kind of forget that as adults we have lots of people around us. But for the very small child, the parents and the immediate family are pretty much their whole world. And so they really need to count on us.
I was at a professional meeting several years ago, and a fellow psychologist was talking with a counselor professionally about how she had never gotten over the death of her father, and this was over 10 years ago. And I'm thinking, I didn't want to be rude and say anything to her, but I'm thinking, get over it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading on grieving, here's this one book written to try to help people, and says she divided her life into BD and AD, before death and after death, and life is never the same and all this. And I'm saying, no, the research for the loss of an immediate family member, which would even include a child or a spouse, we find 10 to 15% of people experience chronic depression. 35 to 40% some disruption for several months to 2 years, and half the people say they only have mild transient symptoms, even from the loss of a spouse or a child parent. You talk about moving on. What do you have in mind when you say moving on?
Well, what I think is important is that people don't know what grief is like. In our society, death education usually comes after the fact because we just don't want to talk about it. And so something happens, someone dies, and suddenly you cannot even imagine how you're going to go on. That person is physically gone, and this is just striking to you because you're used to having that person there every day or perhaps most of the time, and your emotions are out of control. And the first thing that people want to do is shrink away from it. They want it to go away, and they don't even want to think about moving forward. They really want to go back. They want to go back to before this happened because that was their comfort zone. But the thing that you have to do is tell yourself the truth. You have to acknowledge that this has happened. And I believe that you have to go inside yourself. I think that most of our resources, most of our security, and our problem-solving skills start inside instead of outside. You can look for counselors and books and groups and things, and those are very helpful. But I think we need to start inside and say to ourselves, this is different. Everything has changed. And this person is gone. I need to think about myself as an individual now without that person. And we also need to remind ourselves that just because you're moving on, you're not leaving that person behind. You're really taking them with you. You take them in your heart and in your mind. Hopefully you have some kind of a memorial or a legacy. But I think the way to start is to simply acknowledge to yourself that the truth is I am now without that person, and I need to rebuild my life. This is very difficult, and that's why I did a 5-CD program to help people do this, because nobody ever tells you what you need to do.
One of the phrases that caught my imagination in your book was you said, we hate to change.
Mm-hmm.
And while we feel like we're not changing on the inside, the way the world treats us changes us anyway. And I think part of what you were saying, too, is sometimes you feel like you're disloyal to the person if you aren't feeling sad and depressed for maybe forever, and that there's kind of a role like this that a lot of people adopt out of a sense of obligation or loyalty, and I don't think that's what the deceased would really have wanted.
That's true. People feel a little bit guilty. Sometimes people feel that they can't laugh, they can't go out and have fun. They have to keep a very low profile, a very somber demeanor, and really, that person probably would love to see you laugh and have a good time. My husband had arthritis, and it was painful, but on the other hand, he was the kind of person who believed life was meant to be enjoyed, not endured. And I knew that if he thought that I or the whole family were just sitting around moping because of his death, that he would give us a stern talking to. And so I would remind the kids of this, and I would say, you know, your dad was the kind of guy who, no matter what happened, he saw something funny in it, and we have to pick up ourselves and move forward, and we cannot just sit here and wallow in this. It's hard to do, but that's part of the legacy. So that's what I try to teach other people.
And while we have more resources, more services from funeral homes, more grief groups, more psychologists and counselors, our culture doesn't provide the support that it used to. It used, you know, if you grew up on a farm and a spouse died, you had kids, you know, you tried to remarry soon so they would have two parents and could carry on. In Jewish tradition, I love the way it maps out. Here's what you do the first 7 days. Here's what you do the first 30 days. Here's what your obligations are after 11 months and after 12 months. It's all mapped out so you can feel like I've met my obligations and it's okay for me to move on.
Right. Well, having some kind of a formula like that, I think, helps people to structure themselves because you feel like you're just at odds. It's hard to focus. your cognitive thinking is just very muddled. And so today, because people will come for a little while, they'll come to the service, they may stop by the house, but within a couple of weeks, everybody's gone. It really leaves the grievers pretty much on their own. And this is devastating. There are other societies much less sophisticated than ours that do a much better job. They're there for maybe 6 months. Some people will just move in with the family and help them. And so our ability, I think, to heal and to not have this lingering grief for years and years and years is to deal very adequately, very actively. I talk about active grief rather than passive grief, because the active grief is the actual feeling it. It's work. It's called grief work for a reason. It really is hard work. And so this is something that we need to do. And then we can see ourselves get to the point where we can say, ah, I'm starting to feel better. And that's a wonderful feeling for people.
Exactly. We're talking with award-winning author Judy Strong, author of No Time to Grieve, A Survivor's Guide to Loss and Healing. You phrase it as a guide, and that's a good term for it. It's a small book, kind that's perfect to hand to somebody who has just had a loss, because at that point you're so overwhelmed you can hardly concentrate to read a page or two, and this breaks it down to a couple pages on each of a number of issues, very readable, not an overwhelming tome. The website is notimetogrieve.com. And you also are just about to come out with another website, judystrong.com, that's a little more comprehensive and will get into, you know, what to tell children and those kinds of things. Anything else we should know about the book or the websites?
Well, I think that as I began to build the new website and I began to write the second book, I realized that what I really want to do, aside from just helping people through those early stages of grief, both the emotions and the practical issues, is that I want to dwell more on the moving forward and helping people rebuild their lives, because that's the positive aspect of it.
We'll get back to Judy Strong in just a moment. Note how old you feel now, you will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We are brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change. A change in how you view aging, and I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a feel-good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Judy Straw.
And the practical part is also important. I spend a lot of time in the beginning of the book talking about all those documents you have to find, too. And so that's an important part of the grief process.
That's a good transition, because I wanted to shift to the logistics. Obviously, one of the first things you have to deal with is organizing the funeral. What are the key helpful tips that you've found that people might normally not think of when it comes to organizing all that goes with a funeral?
Well, first of all, if people have planned something, if they've already decided, if they've talked about their funeral and they have a place where they've chosen a burial place and a type of funeral, a type of disposition of the body, that's great, but so few people actually do that. I learned that as I sat down and worked with the funeral director, there were a lot of things that I didn't know. They're very good about telling you what kinds of options are available, but I think it's a good idea for the primary griever to take another person with them. I took a couple of my children with me, the older ones, and we sat down and talked about possibilities, and you have to talk about the money aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You have to talk about the cost for everything, and this is a time when you're very emotional. And so it's easy to get carried away and end up doing things, buying things, perhaps, that you really can't afford. So this is a very serious and a very practical consideration.
One of the things I found is in 1984, the Federal Trade Commission passed a law that you have a right to buy your own casket, which is one of the most expensive parts of the funeral. So you can go online in minutes and order a casket for about half the price and have it shipped to the funeral home, and the funeral home has to accept that, and the law says they can't raise their other fees or otherwise hold it against you that you didn't buy the casket from them for twice the price.
That's right. And this is, so the casket and the embalming are the two most expensive things. And people have the option of having a funeral, which is with the body present, or a memorial service, which is without the body. You can have both. You can actually, in some places, rent a casket if you want to have a reviewal with an open casket and then have cremation and just a memorial service. You can actually do that. So there are a lot of options. And my ideal situation is if people sit down and talk about this and get this information beforehand. It's hard to convince people to do this. But if you do it beforehand and kind of make a budget, then you know you're not going to be taken by surprise.
I had never heard of renting a casket. That's amazing.
I think some places will let you do that.
If somebody is just really, really financially strapped, what's the least expensive way to do a funeral?
Actually, a memorial service with cremation would be the most economical. And in this case, you don't need a casket. You can just have a gathering at the funeral home, or if you have a place of worship, or really you could just have it anywhere. You could really have a gathering in your home. After the cremation, they will put the cremains in a box, and you can either keep them that way. You can buy an urn. We bought a nicer box, and then we bought a cemetery plot, and we had the cremains buried, but you don't have to do that. You can scatter them, and this would probably be the most economical. Some people really choose this not just for economic reasons either. They do it for maybe the fact that they want to sprinkle the cremains in their garden, or they want to bury them under a tree or something.
I'm curious, for people who keep an urn, how do they tend to view that urn, or what does it mean to them?
If the cremains are in the urn, I think for people who want to do that and want to maybe save it, keep it in the home somewhere, maybe it's a reminder to them of this person. People have different feelings at different times. Some people might want to have the feeling of this person still being close to them, and that might last for a year or several years, and at some later point they might say, well, okay, I'm going to move on with this, put the urn in a burial ground or put it in another place where it isn't as visible. I think that as we move forward, we're gradually letting go of that person. And I found, actually, that my kids would drive out to the cemetery and they would visit the grave. And we had talked about the fact that the person really isn't there, and yet sometimes having a tangible place for people to go and just kind of tend to it, put some flowers there, make sure that the stone is brushed off, is kind of a loving gesture toward that person. It's staying close for a little while.
When you were talking about the urn, it struck me the parallel of visiting a gravesite, that having some physical place to at least pull your emotions and thoughts together and feel a sense of communication, or at least closeness to the person. One of the tips that you gave was, I hate to be cynical, but there are people who read the obituaries and burglarize homes while people are at the funeral. So you say, get somebody to stay at your home or watch your home.
That's right. The funeral director warned me about this. They put in a short obituary first in the paper and then a longer one later, and they don't give the address, but somebody can always find that out if they look in the phone directory. And they said, make sure you have somebody sitting in the home, not just across the street watching, but actually have somebody sitting at home who is probably not going to go to the service. This is a horrible thing, but it does happen. There would be nothing worse than coming home from a service and finding out that you had been burglarized.
One of the challenges is that you need a box full of records. How do you organize all the records that you need and not have to go back repeatedly to get another copy of a certified death certificate or something?
I think that what's important is, as you get certain documents, have a particular place where you put them and write it down. I recommend that people get a spiral notebook or a yellow legal pad or something. Usually we don't know where these papers are. I really didn't. I had no idea where my marriage license was. My husband did not have a will. And so I had to go digging in desk drawers, and we did have a safe deposit box. I looked in there was a big box at the back of the closet. And this is what people end up doing. My recommendation, though, is gather all these things together. I have one of my papers that I give people lists the five most important documents, and then about 10 after that that may or may not be part of your life. And take them all out. Go wherever you need to go to get them. Get them all gathered together and start to write down exactly what you have. And if you find that there are some things you haven't found, there are ways to get them. It takes a little time, and it may cost you a little money. But once you get them all together, have a specific place. Maybe you'll have to even get a larger safe deposit box. But write down exactly what's in it and what they mean. Who this pertains to. If you have divorce papers, you may need to find out who qualifies for that person's Social Security. If you have discharge papers from the service, you might be entitled to some veterans benefits, which I learned sometimes a lot of people are and they don't even know it. Widows don't know that they're entitled to some benefits and they just never collect them. So the thing to do is to start getting organized. Write it down. Put it all together and put it away, and then when you need it, you'll know where it is.
I would make another suggestion. You know, we're focusing on somebody dying, but there's also the tragedy that sometimes there are fires and hurricanes and thefts, and while you're getting these documents together, it would be a good time to make a copy or scan a copy or something, and keep the copies or a disk of scanned copies or something in some off-site location, like in a safety deposit box or at a relative's house or something, so that if, God forbid, you lost the originals of these documents, you would at least know, well, what hospital they were born in or what county the divorce was in or whatever, and could reconstruct it much more quickly and easily.
That's right, and some people have done that. They have the paper copies, and they have their list, and then they put it on their computer, and then they give a disk maybe to a friend and a relative so that in case something like that happens, they'll know where it is.
Or for that matter, if something happened to multiple family members.
That's right. Sometimes the grown children don't know anything about their parents' affairs, and sometimes I'm finding in talking with baby boomers right now that they're trying to get their parents to get their affairs in order, and the parents are putting it off. And at the same time, some baby boomers are also losing a spouse, so they really have quite a lot of things to deal with right now.
Oh, it can be pulling teeth getting parents to come up with the documents.
People tend to say, oh, I have plenty of time, and hopefully they do. My husband did not have a will. I kept trying to get him to write one, and he kept saying there's plenty of time. And, you know, it's wonderful if you do, but in those tragic times when you don't, I had to go to probate court because there was no will, and I had minor children. We didn't have power of attorney. I didn't know his Social Security number. This is another thing that people need to know, because nobody ever memorizes anybody's number but their own, but you need to know that. So if you can't find their card, it's really going to be a little difficult.
And you want the Social Security numbers for all your children handy, too.
Right.
And these days you get those practically at birth.
Right. That's right.
So you probably want to get at least a half a dozen death certificates, because a number of agencies want their copy of it. You mentioned probate. One of the easiest ways to keep a lot of things out of probate is just any bank account, any stock account or something, do payable on death too. And that way it just automatically goes to whoever is named and doesn't have to go through probate.
That's right. In fact, right after my husband died, because he didn't have a will, I wrote a will, and then a few years later I got a living trust. And when you do that, everything goes into the trust and you can avoid that. You also will avoid a lot of the hassle because that will force you to get all your papers together. Having power of attorney, of course, that ends when the person dies, but if they should be, like in the situation my husband was in, he was in the hospital for 5.5 weeks and became brain damaged. If you don't have the ability through a legal document to make decisions, it's going to be a little bit more difficult for you.
Oh, it can be terribly difficult. So you want the living will that specifies the kind of care that the person wants if they're incapacitated, and or the healthcare power of attorney that will designate someone like a spouse to make decisions if incapacitated. Otherwise, you get somebody in a coma or something, you have to go to the court and get guardianship, which is a very complicated, lengthy process. It can be a real nightmare.
It really is. And you're going through these things at a time when you're already very emotionally unstrung. You're tired. You're having a hard time making decisions and coping. And so people really are doing themselves and their families a favor if they just do this when they can and not wait until there's a tragedy.
Right. And the other document, since we're kind of on this, would be power of attorney for financial matters, which again is easy to get when the person is still competent, but once they pass the point where they're no longer competent because of dementia or, you know, coma or something like that, then it becomes a very convoluted process to do something with the bank accounts and other financial matters that are just sitting there.
Well, actually, I had to go through this because I didn't have power of attorney, and my husband was still in the hospital, and his boss called me one day and he said, "Judy, meet me at the hospital. We have to take care of something." As it had happened, on his pension, which he didn't live to realize for himself, he was 59 when he died, but people don't realize that a pension is not necessarily a death benefit for the surviving spouse. It's really a pension for the employee, and people get to choose a little box so that when they do retire, they either get the full amount, they get part of the amount. There are several different boxes you can choose, and most people don't really read that. They don't ask questions. And he had checked the box that said when he retired, he would get the maximum amount every month until he died. And my husband's boss said, "You know, if Doug dies," and we were pretty sure he was not going to make it, he said, "You're not going to get anything." So he very graciously said, "Meet me at the hospital." We went down to the hospital, and through the hospital lawyer, we had this changed, and I was very grateful for that.
Boy, that's, you were very fortunate.
That was a very kind thing to do.
What other things did you learn about organizing documents and how to deal with agencies like Social Security and VA?
Well, Social Security, actually, I was entitled to SSA, which is part of the Social Security program. This is for minor children who have lost a parent. I called Social Security. I wasn't old enough. I was only 50 when my husband died, so I wasn't old enough, but I could get funds for the two teenaged boys, and I called them. They assigned me. What they will do is assign you one person who talks to you and tells you all the different documents they need. I had to send in about six of these. I had to have a birth certificate for everybody. I had to have our marriage license and a death certificate. And you do need a lot of them. I think I got 20, and I only have a few left. I had to send in a death certificate, and then they will call you. They set up an appointment to call you at a specific time and day where they talk to you about what your benefits are going to be and how they will send them and everything. So they really are very thorough about that. But Social Security, there's one number in the phone book, it's the only number you'll find in the phone book. If you want, like, a local office number, you have to call that number and talk to somebody, and it's one of these long menus. So when you do get somebody on the line, you want to get directions or an address or a phone number, make sure you write them down, because it's a difficult process to find a local place where you can talk to someone.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that children's benefits aren't just for disabled children, but in a case like yours, you were able to get Social Security benefits for the children, even though you were well under 60.
Yes, yeah. They got the benefits. The way they set it up is the children receive it until they turn 18 or graduate from high school. And this really helped. It's not a great deal. It wasn't a large amount, but it helped every month because it took me a while before I was able to get a better job. And so this helped immensely.
And then you've also got this strange little bracket of time when you turn 60, you can draw on your spouse's Social Security benefits, even though you're not eligible for Social Security on your own work record.
That's right. And at the time I was still working, I had finished college and I got a license to substitute teach. And so I think I was 61 when I applied, took his, and I'm still taking his because his was greater than mine was. I had not worked that long. I'd been a homemaker for many years. So I could stay on his, even though I remarried, because I remarried after I was 65. So these are all things that you can talk to Social Security about. You can actually go on their website and get a lot of information, too.
The bottom line is it's so much better to get organized now instead of when you're under a lot of stress.
Well, stress does a lot of harm to us. We know that. We know that it wreaks havoc on our bodies. It hurts the heart, to the digestive system. Those stressors are difficult, and I think it does make a difference in how you live and how you cope. Whether you start young or even if you don't start so young, learn how to take care of yourself and learn how to solve problems and reduce the stress in your life. I come from actually a very long-lived family. I think part of it is because they were very, I have always thought it's because they were very practical, down-to-earth people, but they always tended to get their ducks in a row and take care of things, and hopefully that's part of the legacy I can pass on to my children.
So having all the logistics organized, such as the documents that we're talking about, and having an idea of how to handle the grieving process, what to tell children, what to tell other family members, how to ask for help, can be enormously helpful in not only moving on, as you said, but being able to be there for children and other family members to discuss the grieving issues instead of being preoccupied with, oh my God, how in the world do I get this document and that document, and I can't find the divorce certificate and so on. We've been talking with award-winning author Judy Strong, author of No Time to Grieve, A Survivor's Guide to Loss and Healing. Her website is notimetogrieve.com, and shortly she'll also have judystrong.com. Judy, I really appreciate you sharing your experiences and your recommendations, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I have enjoyed talking with you, and I like to be able to pass this information along to others. That's a way of giving back, and I would really like to educate the public.
Well, you certainly are giving back. Commentary. The moral is, don't wait for the first blizzard to see if your car is ready for winter. The goal of Ageless Lifestyles is to help you live longer, healthier, and happier. And to do that, you need the coping skills of handling death well, because sooner or later, people we care about are going to die. And you also need to know how to handle the logistics. The time to learn those skills, the time to organize the documents, is now, because when you're dealing with somebody dying or somebody who has just died, you're under a great deal of stress, and it's harder to learn new things. It's harder to come up with the skills, and it's harder to find the time and the energy and the clarity to navigate the bureaucratic labyrinths that you're confronted with. I thought Judy was right on when she said the first task that needs to be addressed is addressing the emotions with family members, especially children. With her teenagers, she focused on seeing their father as a role model and carrying on his legacy and feeling that they were fortunate to have somebody who was such a good role model. With younger children, I think she was right on when she said to focus on security. Many years ago, when I took my PhD exam, there was one question on the test that was absolutely perfect. And it was, would the movie Jaws be more upsetting to adults or children? Why? And cite sources. Well, on the one hand, children have difficulty with object permanence. They watch cartoons and characters die and then they're resurrected. So they struggle with whether dad's really dead, is he going to come back? But on the other hand, they have this tremendous need for security, and as Judy said so well, with the possible exception of parents or some close family members, parents are their lifeline, and they're very insecure about losing a parent. To recap some of the other points, she talked about creating memoirs, possibly journaling, and anticipating a variety of life events that trigger need to revisit how you feel about the person who died and to get some family bonding there. When it comes to logistics, now's a good time to get a copy of a living will and fill in the blanks, to get a healthcare power of attorney, fill in the blanks, and if somebody is very ill, to get a power of attorney for financial matters and get that signed. When it comes to funeral homes, going to a funeral home without any background information is like buying a car without doing any preparation before you go to the showroom. You're at a terrific disadvantage at a very stressful time. You want to take a look at ways that you can avoid probate. Some of the easiest ways are making all financial documents possible, life insurance policies, bank accounts, savings accounts, stocks, bonds, retirement funds, payable on death too, putting property in joint tenancy so that that house passes immediately on to a spouse, if we're talking about a spouse, or when there's more money involved, setting up a trust. Probate's not only an expensive process, but it's a long, drawn-out process that ties up matters for many months. One of the first things you want to check is Social Security. When it comes to VA benefits, most of the funeral homes are very on top of how to capture any VA benefits to help pay the funeral expenses and how to get a marker from the VA for veterans. A disabled surviving spouse can also get considerable VA benefits. I mention this because we probably have a lot of baby boomer listeners whose fathers were veterans and their mothers are becoming physically disabled or mentally disabled and need assisted living or nursing home care. And once you get these financial affairs in order, you want to get them organized in one place, and you want to make some kind of copies that are in some location other than just your house, possibly at a relative's house, in a safety deposit box, in case there were a disaster such as fire, hurricane, flood, burglary. Overall, I love Judy's style. It focuses on what needs to be done, addressing the emotions first, creating the memories, but then moving on and evolving, and she does it in a very reassuring manner. Her book, No Time to Grieve, is not any definitive study of grieving. It's a very practical guide for someone who's going through the process and needs an easy-to-read reference on what do I do now? How do I handle this? Help. Emails. I love getting those emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Feedback on our show last week with Beth Baker on greenhouse alternatives to nursing homes. The most common question by far was, where do I find these places? PioneerNetwork.net, that's PioneerNetwork.net, has a lot of information on them, but doesn't tell you specifically where they are. It does have, however, a link to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. If you want to go directly there, it's just rwjf.org. On that site, it lists all the states that have greenhouse projects that are currently existing, under construction, or under development. The currently existing ones, just in case you're curious, Alabama has 6, Arizona 3, Georgia 1, Kansas 6, Michigan 5, Mississippi 12, Montana 5, Nebraska 1, New York 2, Pennsylvania 4, Texas 4, and Washington State 1. On that site, you can drill down to a map of your state and see where the projects currently existing or under construction are. And a reminder for information on my books, on my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, my free Defy Aging newsletter, personal coaching, or professional speaking services, you can go to notaging.com, that's notaging.com, or drbricke.com, drbricke.com. Next week, be sure to tune in for Flirting After 50, You're Never Too Old to Flirt, Here's How. Until then, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricke, on webtalkradio.net and agelesslifestyles.com, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.